I'm Tanzina Vega. Welcome back to The Takeaway. In our next conversation, a warning. Talk of violence may be disturbing to some listeners.
Take this
On Friday night, a fight erupted outside an event at the Metropolitan Republican Club on Manhattan's Upper East Side. Activists had gathered to protest the event where alt-right leader Gavin McGinnis, founder of the far-right group The Proud Boys, had been invited to speak. After the event, the Proud Boys clashed with protesters, and cell phone footage shows the agitators bragging about the night's bloody outcome.
I ripped that motherfucking mask off and kicked him right in the head. Son of a get the forward.
Go, Max.
They say he's a foreigner, if you weren't able to hear it. Photographer Shay Horse, who was at the scene, tweeted, quote, "I haven't seen a fight that violent in a long time. The Proud Boys were totally ready and willing to be violent tonight. They didn't even wear masks." It wasn't the only incident of violence involving the group over the weekend. On the other side of the country, in Portland, Oregon, the Proud Boys got into an even larger fight with a local far-left group who considered themselves Antifa. Here to help us make sense of all this is Tanya Hernandez, professor of law at Fordham University and the author of the forthcoming book Multiracials and Civil Rights, and David Nywert, author of Alt America, The Rise of the Radical Right in the Age of Trump, and a correspondent for the Southern Poverty Law Center. Tanya and David, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yes, likewise.
David, let's start with you. For those who don't know who the Proud Boys are, what's their agenda?
Basically, they want to engage in street violence against radical leftists and Antifa folks, as they like to call them. They're street brawlers, and they want to go out there and fight and defend Donald Trump and the radical right.
We definitely know that the street brawling element, we saw that happen in New York City and, of course, in Portland. But tell us a little bit about Gavin McGinnis. This is somebody who is a very prominent media executive here in New York City, no?
Yeah. No, he's been doing very well. I mean, he's one of the co-founders of Vice. And of course, he left in, I think, 2014, something like that. He's a very savvy media manipulator. And he has a regular show that is very popular with the alt-right.
And I'm wondering, what types of folks are signing up, or, if you will, where are the members of this group coming from? Who are becoming members of the Proud Boys?
Well, typically, you know, white males between the ages of 15 and 30. That's who they're recruiting. And it's right-wing males. And, you know, I mean, geographically, most of them are coming from the suburbs and exurbs. But it's pretty widespread.
Tanya, I want to bring you in here. Let's talk about the history, a little bit about the history of where the Proud Boys fit into our history with hate groups. I was thinking back to when I was growing up in New York City and there were quote-unquote skinheads and you saw them every now and then. But are the Proud Boys unique?
I think they're a part of our shift in culture. And what I mean by that is, to say white supremacy in our most recent past was to trigger a notion of white pride and all kinds of hatred against even the idea of racial integration. Our move over time, right, has been to, as a nation, embrace a sense of, oh, no, we're more than just white and we can take pride in being more than just white. So what is so fascinating, and I have to say disturbing, about the Proud Boys and some of these other youth culture pro-white organizations is that they're actually attracting men of color and men who identify as mixed race as well. Part of that that I find so disturbing is that it enables the organizations to say, see, we're not racist. We're just pro-white as a culture. And anybody who wants to join that is welcome to join us, including these men of color who are sort of also very much enamored of the idea of whiteness as a status. And also the key binary here is that anti-blackness is a key feature of their platform.
What is the driving force behind men, and in particular some men of color, to have joined this group? Is it racism? Is it misogyny? Is it both?
It is both. I mean, talk about a paradigmatic intersectional example, that is the conflation together of both anti-gender bias and race bias. The ways in which this is, I guess, you know, you would say very toxic white masculinity, and men of color are no exception to sort of being seduced by the superficial power that offers up.
Is it becoming easier to sell in this current climate?
It is most definitely easy to sell because it combines both quotes of Martin Luther King about not being racist at the same time that it talks about whiteness as being a culture that is worth uplifting, as if you could take away from this racism.
I'm just curious how it is that people of color who are not by definition white can engage with that type of thinking.
Because what they do is they disassociate this idea of whiteness as culture from racism. And any anti-blackness is also reduced to the idea of, oh, it's not about blackness, it's about bad black culture.
David, what's your sense of that? I mean, are you seeing, is this a new form of hate group ideology that we're seeing across the United States?
Well, in some ways, it's actually very old. I mean, I started doing this when I was covering the Aryan Nations in Idaho in the late 70s and early 80s. And they, too, claimed that they were only pro-white. And it's one of the realities of white supremacist groups is that, you know, they'll claim to just be pro-white and defending white interests, but inevitably their pro-white advocacy becomes attacks on other races. But that's not how they sell themselves. And of course, what really is the underlying dynamic here is less white supremacism than authoritarianism. And that's what they're selling. And authoritarianism crosses all kinds of racial and ethnic and religious boundaries. You know, we've got one of our main sort of Proud Boy groups out here on the West Coast is called Patriot Prayer. And they're headed by a guy who's Japanese American, and his right hand man is this big Samoan guy. So, yeah, we get, and I see all kinds of non-white guys joining their ranks. But when I talk to them, every one of them has what we call a right-wing authoritarian personality.
Tanya, you wanted to weigh in here.
Well, David, I just wanted to throw in the idea that it's not new, but yes, it is in some respects. And in as much as that now these white supremacist groups are claiming to be welcoming to people of color, not just that their pro-whiteness is just about culture and that they're not actually racist, but they're okay with having non-white members be part of their bandwagon. And while they may be very much about authoritarianism, and I agree with you there, they're also spouting lots of pro-white rhetoric that I don't think we should, you know, be dismissing. That is to say, in as much as it's about authoritarianism, it doesn't mean that it's not about race.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. It is this very interesting mix. And it's also, it's an interesting mix of old and new because they're marketing it in ways that I mean, always the radical right was very backward looking. And this shape of the radical right is very savvy, very media savvy, and very forward looking, which is problematic.
Well, I also want to talk about the initial response to this here, at least in New York City. The NYPD, the New York Police Department, said on Monday that it did have plans to arrest 9 members of the Proud Boys and 3 more anti-fascist opponents. But footage from the fight that night shows the police arriving. They dispersed the crowds, but none of the Proud Boys actually were arrested. And there were some accusations that the police, the NYPD, didn't do enough to stop the attackers. There was also an assumption that there was support here from the implicit support for the Proud Boys from the NYPD. David, do you think there's a level of support within law enforcement for far right groups like the Proud Boys?
Yes, I do. I believe that actually our law enforcement system throughout the country right now is being, you know, very heavily politicized by organizations like the Oath Keepers, which specifically, you know, this is essentially a patriot, very far right organization that is recruiting law enforcement, and they're succeeding. So, yeah, I've been out covering a lot of these, and I would say Portland police in particular are very prone to acting in defense of the right-wing side and very much acting against they very much see the anti-fascists as the bigger problem. And I think that's a problem.
Tanya, your thoughts.
You know, what I find fascinating about this, David, is that I think another aspect of this is that even for the police officers who don't actually view themselves as being invested in this white supremacist authoritarianism, I think are very much swayed by the idea that what they are observing are, it's just about free speech, right? That these folks are just spouting their ideas. And I think that's part of the underlying problem here is the stereotype of the United States as being so absolutist about free speech that you can say any kind of hateful thing on the street and it doesn't matter. And it doesn't seem to mean that it results in violence, although history shows us how intimately intertwined racist speech is with racist violence.
I do want to point out that we did reach out to the NYPD, the Takeaway did, for comment about their response specifically to this incident and also the claim that Gavin McGinnis said that he actually was supported by the NYPD. So I'm going to read you a brief response from the NYPD. And they say that they called McGinnis an individual who's a provocateur who does not speak for the NYPD. They say the NYPD is a diverse institution dedicated to keeping safe all 8.5 million New Yorkers. Violence and disorder like what occurred on October 12th is unacceptable and will not be tolerated. And the statement does go on. So they did respond to this request. At the national level, what do you see? Do you see this as a trend that's going to continue to catch on? Is this something that'll go back underground? What's your experience tell you?
Yeah, my experience doesn't really help with this because this is all new. I think we all hope that it goes back underground, but I'm not very hopeful in that regard because I think this is very much a creature of the internet.
David Nyward is the author of Alt America, The Rise of the Radical Right in the Age of Trump, and a correspondent for the Southern Poverty Law Center. And Tanya Hernandez is a professor of law at Fordham University and author of the forthcoming book, Multiracials and Civil Rights.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.